Chapter 51. Thomas Orley. With trembling hands, he pulled vines away from the cave entrance. He crept out of his shelter and blinked at the hazy morning. A thick layer of low clouds had gathered. There were no alien ships yet, and that was just as well. He had feared they would arrive while he was helpless, struggling against the effects of the psi bomb. It hadn't been fun. In the first few minutes, the psychic blasts had beaten away at his hypnotic defenses, cresting over them and drenching his brain in alien howling. For 2 hours, it had felt like eternity. He had wrestled with crazy images, pulsing nerve-evoked lights and sounds. Tom still shook with reaction. "I sure hope there is still thinning out there, and that they fall for it. It had better have been worth it." According to Jillian, the NIS machine had been confident it had found the right codes in the library taken from the Thenanin wreck. If there were still Thenanin in the system, they should try to answer. The bomb must have been detectable for millions of miles in all directions. He dragged a handful of muck out of the gap in the weeds and flung it aside. Scummy seawater welled up almost to the surface of the hole. Another gap probably lay only a few meters beyond the next hummock. The weedscape flexed and breathed incessantly, but Tom wanted a water entrance near at hand. He scooped away the slime as best he could, then wiped his hands and settled down to scan the sky from his shelter. On his lap, he arranged his remaining psi bombs. Fortunately, these wouldn't pack the wallop of the Thenanin distress call. They were simply pre-recorded message casts designed to carry a brief code a few thousand kilometers. He had only recovered 3 of the message globes from the glider wreck, so he could only broadcast a narrow range of facts. Depending on which bomb he set off, Jillian and Kradaki would know what kind of aliens had come to investigate the distress call. Of course, something might happen that didn't fit into any of the scenarios they had discussed. Then he would have to decide whether to broadcast an ambiguous message or do nothing and wait. Maybe it would have been better to bring a radio, he thought. But a warship in the vicinity could pinpoint a radio transmission almost instantly and blast his position before he spoke a few words. A message bomb could do its work in a second or so and would be much harder to locate. Tom thought about Streaker. It seemed like forever since he had last been there. Everything desirable was there. Food, sleep, hot showers. His woman. He smiled at the way the priorities had come out in his thoughts. Ah, well, Jill would understand. Streaker might have to abandon him if his experiment led to a brief chance to blast away from Kethroop. It would not be a dishonorable way to die. He wasn't afraid of dying, only of having not done all he could and not properly spitting in the eye of death when it came for him. That final gesture was important. Another image came to him, far more unpleasant. Streaker already captured, the space battle already over, all of his efforts useless. Tom shuddered. It was better to imagine a sacrifice being for something. A stiff breeze kept the clouds moving. They merged and separated in thick, wet drifts. Tom shaded his eyes against the glare to the east, about a radian south of the haze-shrouded morning sun. He thought he saw motion in the sky. He huddled deeper into his makeshift cave. Out of one of the eastern cloud drifts, a dark object slowly descended. Swirling vapor momentarily obscured its shape and size as it hung high above the sea of weeds. A faint drumming sound reached Tom. He squinted from his hiding place, wishing for his lost binoculars. Then the mists parted briefly, and he saw the hovering spaceship clearly. It looked like some monstrous dragonfly, sharply tapered and wickedly dangerous. few races delved so deeply into the library for weird designs as did the idiosyncratic, ruthless Tandu. Wild protrusions extended from the narrow hull in all directions, a Tandu hallmark. At one end, however, a blunt, wedge-shaped appendage clashed with the overall impression of careless, cruel delicacy. It didn't seem to fit into the overall design. Before he could get a better view, the clouds came together, concealing the floating cruiser from sight. The faint hum of powerful engines grew slowly louder, however. Tom scratched at an itchy 5-day growth of beard. The Tandu were bad news. If they were the only ones to show themselves, he would have to set off message bomb number 3 to tell Streaker to lock up and get ready for a death fight. This was an enemy with whom mankind had never been able to negotiate. In skirmishes on the galactic marshes, Terran ships had seldom conquered Tandu vessels, even with the odds in their favor. And when there were no witnesses around, the Tandu loved to pick fights. Standing orders were to avoid them at all costs until such time as Timbrimi advisors could teach human crews the rare knack of beating these masters of the sneak and strike. If the Tandu were the only ones to appear, it also meant he had likely seen his last sunrise, for in setting off a message bomb, he'd almost certainly give away his position. The Tandu had clients who could sigh-sniff even a thought if they once caught the mental scent. "Tell you what, Ifni," he thought, "you send someone else into this confrontation. I won't insist it be Thenanin. A Jafur fighting planetoid will suffice. Mix things up here, and I promise to say 5 sutras, 10 Hail Marys, and Kiddush when I get home, okay? I'll even dump some credits in a slot machine if you like." He envisioned a Tibrimi human-Synthian battle fleet erupting out of the clouds, blasting the Tandu to fragments and sweeping the sky clear of fanatics. It was a lovely image, although he could think of a dozen reasons why it wasn't likely. For one thing, the Synthians, friendly as they were, wouldn't intervene unless it was a sure thing. The Tibrimi, for that matter, would probably help Earth defend herself, but wouldn't stick their lovely humanoid necks too far out for a bunch of lost wolflings. "Okay, Ifni, you lady of luck and chance," he fingered bomb number 3, "I'll settle for a single beat-up old Thenanin cruiser." Infinity gave him no immediate answer. He hadn't expected one. The thrumming seemed to pass right over his head. His hackles rose as the ship's strong field region swept the area. Its shield screeched at his modest sigh sense. Then the crawling rumble began slowly to recede to his left. Tom looked to the west. The ragged clouds separated just long enough to display the Tandu cruiser, a light destroyer he now saw, and not really a battleship, only a couple of miles away. As he watched, the blunt appendage detached from the mothership and began to drift slowly to the south. Tom frowned. That thing didn't look like the Tandu scout ships he was familiar with. It was a totally different design, stout and stolid, like... The haze came together again, frustratingly, covering the two ships. Their muttering growl covered the muted grumblings of the nearby volcano. Suddenly, 3 brilliant streams of green light speared down from the clouds where Tom had last seen the Tandu ship to hit the sea with flashing incandescence. There came a peal of supersonic thunder. First he thought the Tandu were blasting the surface below, but a crackling bright explosion in the clouds showed that the destroyer itself was at the receiving end. Something high above the cloud deck was shooting at the Tandu. He was too busy snatching up his gear to waste time in exultation. He kept his head averted, and so was spared blindness as the destroyer began firing actinic beams of antimatter at its assailant. Waves of heat scorched the back of his head and his left arm as he stuffed the psi bombs under his waistband and snapped his breather mask over his head. The beams of annihilation made streaks of solar heat across the sky. He grabbed up his pack and dove into the hole he had earlier cleared in the thickly woven weeds. The thunder suddenly muted as he splashed into a jungle of dangling vines. Straight shafts of flickering battle light speared into the gloom through gaps in the weed. Tom found he was automatically holding his breath. That didn't make much sense. The breather mask would not allow much oxygen to escape, but it would pass carbon dioxide. He started inhaling and exhaling as he grabbed a strong root for an anchor. He found he was laboring for breath. With all the vegetation around him, he had expected the oxygen content to be high. But the tiny indicator on the rim of his mask told him that the opposite was true. The water was depleted compared to the normally rich brine of Kithrup Sea. The waving gill fins of his mask were picking up only a third as much oxygen as he would need to maintain himself, even if he stayed perfectly still. In just a few minutes, he would start to get dizzy. Not long thereafter, he would pass out. The battle roar penetrated the weed cover in a series of dull detonations. Shafts of brilliance shot into the gloom through openings in the leafy roof, one right in front of Orly. Even indirectly, the light hurt his eyes. He saw Franz just above the waterline, which had recently survived ashfall from a volcano, curl from the heat, turn brown, and fall away. "So much for the rest of my supplies," he thought. "So much for coming up for air." He wrapped his legs around the thick root as he shrugged out of his backpack. He started rummaging through the satchel, looking for something to improvise. In the sharp shadows, he negotiated the contents mostly by touch. The inertial tracker Jillian had given him, a pouch of food bars, two canteens of fresh water, explosive slivers for his needler, a toolkit. The air meter was turning an ominous orange. Tom wedged the pack between his knees and tore open the toolkit. He seized a small roll of 8-gauge rubber tubing. Purple blobs flickered on the edge of his field of vision as he used his sheath knife to cut a length of narrow hose. He crammed one end through the mask's chow lock. The seal held, but the contents of the tube sprayed at his mouth, making him gag and cough. There was no time for finesse. He shimmied up the root to a point within reach of the hole in the weeds. Tom pinched the tube below the other end, but bitter, oily water streamed from the tube as he straightened the coil. He averted his face, but swallowed a little anyway. It tasted foul. The mask's demon lock would purge the fluid if too much didn't flood in. Tom reached out and pushed the tube above the surface of the narrow pool where the battle flashes sent shafts of light into the depths. He sucked hard at the hose, spitting out slime and a sharp metallic tang, desperately trying to clear it. One of the searing blasts flashed, scalding his fingers below the waterline. He fought the instinct to shout or pull away from the pain. He felt consciousness begin to slip, and with it the will to hold his left hand into the searing heat. He drew hard, and at last was rewarded with a thin stream of dank air. Tom sucked frantically at the line. The hot, steamy air tasted of smoke, but it nourished. He exhaled into the mask, trusting it to hold the hard-won oxygen. The aching in his lungs subsided, and the agony of his hand took the fore. Just as he thought he couldn't hold it out there any more, the burning heat from above subsided, fading to a dull, flickering glow in the sky. A few meters away was another gap in the weeds where he might be able to prop the tube between two thick roots without exposing himself. Tom took a few more breaths, then pinched the tube shut. But before he could prepare any further, a sharp blue light suddenly filled the water, brighter than ever, casting stark, blinding shadows everywhere. There was a tremendous detonation. Then the sea began tossing him about like a rag doll. Something huge had struck the ocean and set it bucking. His anchor root came free of its mooring, and he fell into a maelstrom of flailing vines. The swell tore the backpack from him. He grabbed after it and caught the end of one strap, but something struck him in the back of the head, knocking him dizzy. The pack was snatched away into the noise and flashing shadows. Tom curled into a ball, his forearms holding the rim of his mask against the whipping vines. His first thought, on coming around, was a vague surprise that he was still breathing. He thought the battle storm was still going on until he realized that the shaking he felt was his own body. The roar in his ears was only a roar in his ears. His throbbing left arm was draped over a thick horizontal stump. Scummy green water came up to his chin, lapping against the finned face mask. His lungs ached, and the air was stale. He brought up his trembling right hand and pulled the mask down to hang around his neck. The filters had kept out the ozone stench, but he inhaled deeply, gratefully. At the last moment, he must have chosen immolation over suffocation and struck out for the surface. Fortunately, the battle ended just before he arrived. Tom resisted the temptation to rub his itching eyes. The slime on his hands would do them no good. Tears welled at a biofeedback command, flushing most of the blinding mucus away. He looked up when he could see again. To the north, the volcano fumed on as ever. The cloud cover had parted somewhat, revealing numerous twisted banners of multicolored smoke. All around Tom, small crawling things were climbing out from the singed weeds, resuming their normal business of eating or being eaten. There were no longer battleships in the sky, blazing away at each other with beams of nova heat. For the first time, Tom was glad of the monotonous topography of the carpet of vines. He hardly had to rise in the water to see several columns of smoke pouring from slowly settling wrecks. As he watched, one faraway metal derelict exploded. The sound arrived seconds later in a series of muted coughs and pops, punctuated unsynchronously by bright flashes. The dim shape sank lower. Tom averted his eyes from a final detonation. When he looked back, he could detect nothing but clouds of steam and a faint hissing sound that fell away into silence. Elsewhere lay other floating fragments. Tom turned a slow circle, somewhat in awe of the destruction. There was more than enough wreckage for a mid-sized skirmish. He laughed at the irony, although it made his abused lungs hurt. The Galactics had all come to investigate a counterfeit Mayday signal, and they had brought their death feuds along to what should have been a mission of mercy. Now they were dead, while he still lived. This didn't feel like the random capriciousness of Ifni. It was too like the mysterious wry work of God himself. "Does this mean I'm all alone again?" he wondered. That would be rich. So much fireworks and one humble human, the only survivor. Not for long, perhaps. The battle had caused him to lose almost all of the supplies he had struggled so hard to recover. Tom frowned suddenly. The message bombs. He clutched at his waist, and the world seemed to drop away. Only one of the globes remained. The others must have popped out in the struggle below the clinging vines. When his right hand stopped shaking, he carefully reached under his waistband and drew out the psi bomb, his very last link with Streaker, with Jillian. It was the verifier, the one that he was to set off if he thought the Trojan Seahorse should fly. Now he would have to decide whether to set off this one or none at all. Yes or no were all he could say. "I only wish I knew whose ships those were that fired on the Tandu." Tucking the bomb away, he resumed his slow turn. One wreck on the northwest horizon looked like a partially crushed eggshell. Smoke still rose from it, but the burning seemed to have stopped. There were no explosions, and it seemed not to be sinking any lower. All right, Tom thought. That will do as a goal. It looks intact enough to have possibilities. It may have salvageable gear and food. Certainly its shelter, if it's not too radioactive. It seemed only 5 kilometers away or so, though looks could be deceiving. A destination would give him something to do, at least. He needed more information. The wreck might tell him what he needed to know. He pondered whether to try to go by land, trusting his weary legs to negotiate the weedscape, or to attempt the journey underwater, swimming from air hole to air hole, daring the unknown creatures of the deep. He suddenly heard a warbling whine behind him, turned, and saw a small spacecraft about a kilometer away, heading slowly northward, wavering bare meters above the ocean. Its shimmering fields flickered, its drives heaved and faltered. Tom pulled up his mask and prepared to dive, but the tiny ship wasn't coming his way. It was passing to the west of him, sparks shooting from its stubby stasis flanges. Ugly black streaks stained its hull, and one patch had blistered and boiled away. Tom caught his breath as it passed. He had never seen a model like this before, but he could think of several races whose style would be compatible with the design. The scout dipped as its dying drives coughed. The high whine of the gravity generator began to fall. The boat's crew obviously knew it was done for. It banked to change course for the island. Tom held his breath, unable to help sympathizing with the desperate alien pilot. The boat sputtered along just above the weeds, then passed out of sight behind the mountain's shoulder. The faint crump of its landing carried over the whistling of the trade winds. Tom waited. After a few seconds, the boat's stasis field released with a loud concussion. Glowing debris flew out over the sea. The fragments quenched in water or burned slowly into the weeds. He doubted anyone could have gotten away in time. Tom changed goals. His long-range destination was still the eggshell ship, floating a few miles away. But first he wanted to sift through the wreckage of that scout boat. Maybe there would be evidence there to make his decision easier. Maybe there would be food. He tried to crawl up onto the weeds, but found it too difficult. He was still shaking. All right, then. We'll go under the sea. It's probably all moot anyway. I might as well enjoy the scenery.